Now Ephesians chapter 6. The sharp among you will have noticed that we've committed the unforgivable sin and fallen a week behind on our schedule of preaching on Sunday mornings. So Happy Mondays, which should have been today, is going to be postponed until some Sunday evening in the new year. But today we're finishing our series on the Christian Happy Families, looking at chapter 6, verses 1 to 4. Ephesians chapter 6, verses 1 to 4. Where the apostle writes, "Obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you, and that you may enjoy long life on the earth. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord." Someone has said that child rearing is a bit like learning to play the violin in public. No doubt rewarding in the long term, but a sore trial to our patience and a cruel embarrassment to our pride in the meanwhile. Of course, you do meet people who assure you that they've never had any trouble with theirs and don't intend to have any trouble with their little treasures. I'm always inclined to put such words in the category of famous last words. "Wait and see," I say. Until our children have grown to at least the age of 30, it's too early to boast about them. In fact, if we're honest, we know they aren't little angels. A quick glance in the creche this morning will lead any unprejudiced observer to conclude that Daniel's den of lions was probably a rest home by comparison. From the terrible twos to the tortuous teens, children are not easy, and anybody who says they are is deceiving themselves. But then, of course, parents have their faults too, don't they? Parents can be a bit of a pain. No doubt our children, who we've just sent out, would have a few comments of their own to make from the other side of the family fence if we let them. And those of us upon whom the mantle of parental responsibility has fallen perhaps forget rather too quickly just what a painful, traumatic business growing up is and what a hindrance father and mother can be in the accomplishment of it. It's the rare adult who has absolutely no complaints about the way he or she was brought up. So it would be unlikely if our children were any exception to that, don't you think? What's interesting about the advice the Apostle Paul has in this particular passage is that he has words of challenge for both sides, for the children and for the parents. That's quite an important observation because societies have tended historically to give preference to one side or the other of the generation gap. Most ancient societies were parent-centered. If children went wrong, it was the children's fault in the ancient world. In modern times, there's been a total reversal of that. Our societies could be justly categorized as child-centered. From the moment of birth, the infant is cosseted and indulged. Not infrequently, the success of the children is the chief goal of a marriage. So if a modern child turns out badly, it's the parents who are to blame. Paul doesn't really surrender to either of those simplistic points of view. No, he says, the true centre of a family should be neither the parent nor the child. He relates both to a third centre. Obey your parents in the Lord, he says, children. Fathers, bring your children up in the training and instruction of the Lord, he says. For in this happy family, neither the parent nor the child is sovereign, but Christ is the Lord of both. This is in fact, one further example, one further illustration of that basic dictum that Paul enunciated to us a couple of Sundays back in chapter 5, verse 21. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ, he said. For Paul, you remember, the most important social virtue, the most vital social virtue, if human relationships in any context are to be happy, is humility. The humility which can exercise leadership, when leadership is our role, without abusing that privilege of power. And the humility which can accept leadership, when accepting leadership is our proper role, without resenting that lack of power. And it's precisely in this he's told us that Christ is such a supreme example. For he is the meek and lowly one, the king who rules from the cross, the one who said, "I did not come to be served, but to serve." Submit to one another, then, he says, out of reverence for Christ. Now, Paul has already illustrated how this works out in the context of the husband-wife relationship, and we've looked at that in a couple of weeks. But now he moves on to his second example, that of the parent-child. This, too, is an asymmetric relationship, and less controversially so, I guess. There is a stronger party, the parent, and there is a weaker party, the child. And the key to being a happy family, says Paul, lies in each of those parties recognizing their role and having the Christ-based humility to fulfill the responsibility of that role without either authoritarianism on the one hand or rebellion on the other, which would distort the pattern. So children obey, he says. Fathers don't exasperate them. Let's look in more detail then at both those sides of Paul's domestic equation. First, the children. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honour your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may enjoy long life on the earth. There are three things, I think, which is worth pointing out in regard to the way Paul presents this requirement to children to be obedient. Firstly, you notice he treats children as in need of moral guidance. Unlike some, he would not assume that children were naturally good or were naturally aware of what their responsibilities were or that they were below the age of moral awareness, nor does he suggest that children should be allowed to discover right and wrong by some process of experiment. No, he says, children are in need of moral guidance. They may properly be instructed. So he instills moral norms in the imperative. Children, obey your parents. This is right, he says. You'll notice, too, secondly, that he treats children as spiritually responsive. Obey your parents, he says, in the Lord. Some modern educationalists would suggest that psychological immaturity is a barrier for any child responding to Christian things. On the contrary, Paul addresses these children as those for whom God's word and the authority of Christ are fully meaningful. Indeed, you could argue that he is addressing children here as if they were Christians. I say as if advisedly, because it is, if we're honest, very difficult to assess the spiritual condition of a child. Many parents who have made confident statements regarding their child's conversion in infant years have lived to regret their hasty claims in teenage years. But that doesn't invalidate Paul's approach here. He's not just talking, I think, to converted children. He's talking to all the children within the congregation of God's people there at Ephesus. Children, in other words, from Christian homes. And such children, he suggests, are properly addressed as spiritually responsive. But perhaps most importantly, what I want you to notice is that he speaks to children here as rational agents. Children, obey your parents in the Lord. This is right. Honour your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise that it may go well with you and that you may enjoy long life on the earth. Now you see, he could very easily have left verse 1 as a naked command. Obey your parents, this is right, full stop, that's the end of it. And of course, sometimes children do have to accept such unexplained imperatives. We have to learn to obey our parents long before we are capable of understanding as we should. But clearly Paul considers it's very desirable to give children reasons for what he says they should do. It's all the difference in the world, isn't there, between the parent who says to the child as it dashes towards the curb, "If you do that again, I'll kill you." And the child who says, and the parent who says, "If you do that again, you will be killed." Education, you see, without explanation is what we call indoctrination. And indoctrination is a very bad thing. It's a very bad thing for, again, three reasons. First, because it fails to do justice to the humanness of children. Children have got minds. Untutored minds, maybe, but minds nevertheless. Instruments of independent thought. That's what distinguishes them from brute beasts. That's what affiliates them to the image of God. To compel children to mindless obedience is an affront to their human dignity. It's to reduce them to being slaves of the adult world, rather than what they really are, which is the heirs of the adult world. Indoctrination is a bad thing, secondly, because in the long run it's always ineffective. Of course, authoritarianism may achieve a measure of success while the child is protected from the competitive ideas of the outside world. But the time inevitably comes when that outside world breaks in upon the child. And when it does, the fact that Dad says so is no longer sufficient. It has become apparent to the child then, you see, that Dad is not the paragon of virtue he once considered him. The illusion of parental infallibility has been irretrievably smashed. And once that begins to happen in a child's consciousness, slowly but surely the child begins to build their own world of private ideas. At first that happens secretly, under the cloak of continuing conformity to parental authority. But as self-consciousness grows, so does the pressure to break loose of that control and, if necessary, to defy it. So it is in those critical adolescent days that behavioural patterns which have been based simply on doing as you are told become nothing but an incentive to rebellion. In the long term, indoctrination is ineffective. But thirdly, indoctrination, I think, is extremely spiritually dangerous. Quite a few Christian parents have commented to me in recent years about children who have joined eccentric cults, many of them of the sort of New Age variety that we've been discussing quite often on these Sunday mornings. It's very worrying that some of these kids who have been taught the Bible, who know what Orthodox Christian belief is, have been trapped by erroneous cults and ideas. The reason for that? Well, no doubt there are many factors involved, but I think one thing which ought to be very seriously considered is this. Just because a child knows what his parents believe, it doesn't follow he understands why they believe it. If all that has happened is that a child has been brainwashed into absorbing the religious beliefs and the moral norms of his parents by their diktat, then it will not be difficult, perhaps, for such a child to submit unquestioningly to the similar spiritual dictatorship of some guru in adolescent years. Authoritarianism breeds a certain kind of compliant personality when it is too successful. The way, then, we must teach our children must not be to infantilize them, it must be rather to develop within them a power of critical personal judgment. There are many hundreds of spiritual con men out there who will happily tell them what to believe. If we don't want our children to be duped by them, then they must learn not only what we believe, but why we believe it from the start. We must give them reasons. We must treat them as rational agents. To fail to do that is to play straight into the hands of the devil, who is the biggest indoctrinator of them all. What reason, then, does Paul give for saying that children should obey their parents? Well, he says it's God's law. That in itself is a reason. It places the instruction beyond simply the bounds of Dad says so, onto some much higher level of moral authority, some universal moral authority, the law of God. But he doesn't even leave it at that. He points out that even God, when he gave this law, added a promise to it. That it may go well with you, and that you may enjoy long life on the earth. He added this additional incentive to this particular rule. In what respect are we to understand that obedience to parents is linked with prosperity, with a long life? Under Jewish law, of course, a disobedient child could be executed. So that phrase, that your days may be long, might have fine very literal application. But I'm quite sure that isn't what was in the mind either of Paul or of Moses, actually, when that law was written. One thing I think that may be at the back of it goes back to this question of authority structures that we've discussed so often in the last few weeks. society can only work successfully if the individuals that comprise that society have the necessary skills to make that society work. And one of the most important of those social skills is the ability to cooperate harmoniously within these asymmetric patterns of authority with which society is necessarily laden. I suppose when we're young adolescents, most of us live under the delusion that once we've severed our mother's apron strings and left home, all those inhibiting thou shalt nots which our parents represent to us will be immediately dissolved, and we will discover an intoxicating freedom to do what we want at last. And of course it is an illusion, as we soon discover that isn't what adult life is like at all. All you discover when you leave the authority of mum and dad is there are a lot of other authorities out there who will tell you what to do just as effectively and with far severer penalties than they had access to. There are policemen out there and customs officers out there. There are taxmen and factory foremen and managing directors and headmasters and deans of faculty and matrons and consultants and landlords and bailiffs and superintendents and inspectors and judges and kings and queens and presidents and prime ministers. Our world is full of them. People empowered to tell you what to do. The whole of civilization is built out of such asymmetric authority structures. Where do we acquire the social skills to fit in compliantly within those structures and make them work? The answer is we are socialized in the family. Any society which allows children to disobey parents is investing in its own future decay. For it is disciplined children that make disciplined citizens. Undisciplined children are incipient anarchists. I know it may sound terribly right-wing and reactionary to say it. Forgive me if you don't. I'm no sort of right-wing extremist. But the Ten Commandments are on my side in this matter. This is why dysfunctional families are so clearly linked to juvenile delinquency and to the statistics of crime in a society. Because it is within the family circle that children are socialized to cooperate harmoniously in authority structures, to respect authority and to obey it. Obedience is not something we leave behind at the age of 15 or 21. We have to go on obeying right through our lives in one way or another. So Paul says, this is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may enjoy long life on the earth. It's not too much to say the survival of civilization is at stake in the obedience of the young. So Paul would have us know then that obedience to parents is good for us. Our well-being, individually and collectively, depends on it. In its absence, we will not have a long life in the land the Lord our God gives to us. And those of us who are children here then ought not to think of obeying our parents as some cruel imposition, some cruel limitation on our freedom. This is our Creator's wisdom. He lays this duty upon us because he knows it's in our best interests. And though it may sound a bit Victorian, at the end of the day, we shall discover obeying your parents is good for you. There is a promise attached to it. But that brings us to the other side of this domestic equation, the parents. And seeing as more of us, I suspect, fall into that category here this morning, let us look very carefully at verse 4. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. A couple of months ago, Julian Reynolds in the Daily Telegraph wrote a remarkably frank article entitled The Nightmare of Guilt. Let me read you a little of it. If being in love means never having to say you're sorry, being a mother means always being in the wrong. When the baby cries, it's your fault. When the toddler pours packets of cornflakes down the lavatory, that's your fault too. When the moody adolescent cultivates a hairstyle with dyed bits and retreats behind a bedroom door to the throbbing strains of Frank Zappa, you know who is really to blame. It doesn't need your own mother or your husband to tell you. It certainly doesn't require the towering rage and quivering indictment of the aforementioned teenager. You know it already. If only you had done everything differently, given them better training, nicer books to read, been stricter, been less strict, then none of this would have happened. The only consolation is that exactly the same thing happens to every other mother. No matter what you do, it's bound to be the opposite of what you should have done. I was really brought up a little short by that article, but the more I thought about it, the more I could see justification in Reynolds' complaint there. Mothers are so often, aren't they, the scapegoat of society's failures to raise the next generation satisfactorily. Male child psychiatrists have seen to that. Freud and Winnicott and Dr. Spock have ensured that maternal guilt is the catch-22 of modern child development theory. They can't escape it. As Gideon Reynolds puts it, motherhood means taking the blame for everything. And one might add, increasingly these days, getting the thanks for nothing. Little wonder that I find quite a few women these days experiencing a strange ambivalence about the prospect of pregnancy. For all that maternal instinct may crave fulfillment in them, children are a formidable responsibility, and according to current social attitudes, it's the mother who must bear by far the greatest part of that burden. Well, frankly, my sympathies are all with Gillian Reynolds. She has every right to feel hard done by, and I don't think I'm alone in that. I reckon the Apostle Paul felt the same way. For you'll notice in these verses that we study this morning, he puts the onus for happy relationships not on the mother at all, but on the father. Fathers, he says, do not exasperate your children, but bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not for one moment suggesting that Paul was dismissive of the mother's role. On the contrary, she's explicitly acknowledged in that quotation from the fifth commandment in verse 2, honor your father and mother. And you can make a good case for saying that that word fathers in verse 4 should be understood to embrace mothers also. Unlike a modern Christian author, you see, Paul did not have a publisher meticulously scouring his manuscript with indelible pencil in hand to eliminate every sexist, non-inclusivist word within it. The apostle was free to follow the common convention of every civilized language, ancient and modern, and make male nouns embrace both male and female genders if he wished. So it may very well be the word fathers in verse 4 could be legitimately rendered parents, and some paraphrases do indeed render it that way. But I wouldn't want to press that point too far. For the fact is, as we've seen in the last couple of weeks, Paul did not see the function of husband and wife in the marital relationship was identical. On the contrary, there's a complementarity of role there. The husband, you remember, in emulation of Christ's headship over the church, is to be the loving leader of his wife, says Paul. And the wife, in emulation of the church's submission to Christ, is to be the willing follower of her husband, he says. This asymmetry, as we've called it, doesn't represent any inequality of human worth or dignity between the sexes. It is simply one more example of the kind of authority structure which we inevitably find in human society. Some, like marriage, are ordained in the Creator's plan. Others, less happily, have been devised by human beings themselves, like the master-slave relationship we shall eventually get onto one of these days. But in any human organization, such authority structures are necessary to efficient, harmonious working in some form or another. And it's only because, you see, men and women have colluded in modern society to blur this authority structure that properly exists in marriage that women like Gillian Reynolds are found complaining of the unfair burden of maternal guilt. According to Paul, it is not necessarily the mother at all who is to blame if children don't turn out well. No, says Paul, children themselves have a responsibility in this matter. They're not passive victims of the family. They contribute to it. They have a responsibility to obey. But more than that, fathers, as the God-appointed leaders of the family, bear prime responsibility for their children's welfare, he says. So you could argue the one person who should not carry the can in this matter is the mother. For according to Paul, the nurture of children is ultimately not her responsibility, but her husband's. Far from being the male chauvinist he's portrayed, you see, Paul is so often on the woman's side in this whole matter. He doesn't direct his comments at the victimized mother of contemporary child development theory, but at the father, who has in our modern world so frequently succeeded in opting out of his God-appointed role as leader in the home. Nowhere has the tragedy of that absent father been more poignantly expressed than in that folk song, The Cat's in the Cradle, which I'm sure some of you have heard, but for those of you who haven't, let me read it to you. My child arrived just the other day. He came to the world in the usual way, but there were planes to catch and bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away, and he was talking before I knew it. And as he grew, he'd say, I'm going to be like you, Dad. You know, I'm going to be like you. And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man in the moon. When are you coming home, Dad? I don't know when, but we'll get together then, son. You know we'll have a good time then. My son turned 10 just the other day. He said, thanks for the ball, Dad. Come on, let's play. Can you teach me to throw? I said, not today. I got a lot to do. He said, that's okay. And he walked away, but his smile never dimmed, and he said, I'm going to be like him. Yeah, you know, I'm going to be like him. And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man in the moon. When are you coming home, Dad? I don't know when, but we'll get together then, son. You know, we'll have a good time then. Well, he came from college just the other day, so much like a man, I just had to say, son, I'm proud of you. Can you sit for a while? He shook his head and he said with a smile, what I'd really like, Dad, is to borrow the car keys. See you later. Can I have them, please? And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man in the moon. When are you coming home, son? I don't know when, but we'll get together then, Dad. You know we'll have a good time then. I've long since retired and my son's moved away. I called him up just the other day. I said, I'd like to see you if you don't mind. He said, I'd love to, Dad, if I can find the time. You see, my job's a hassle and the kids have the flu, but it's sure nice talking to you, Dad. It's sure nice talking to you. And as I hung up the phone, it occurred to me, he'd grown up just like me. My son was just like me. What parents in general, you see, and us fathers in particular, have to understand is that we are models to our children. Far more than anything we say, they learn from what we do, what it means to be a wife or a husband, a mother or a father. The family pattern we set then will be the family pattern the next generation repeats. One of the questions that people have asked me, arising out of last Sunday's address, was this. What do you do if the man of the house is not the natural leader? It's a very valid query. Whilst no doubt male sex hormones do function to make men more aggressive and physically stronger than women on average, everybody knows there are a significant number of couples where it is in fact the wife who has the more self-assertive personality and where the husband is the more naturally submissive one. Is there anything wrong in such a marriage with reversing the asymmetry, allowing the woman to take the initiative and the man to follow her lead? Well, in the the sense that such a marriage can certainly survive, I suppose one has to say there's nothing wrong with it. Such a relationship may well be happy and secure. One has seen cases of families, of marriages, which seem to work that way around and survive a lifetime. But such a pattern of role reversal from the biblical norm will have disastrous consequences if children are involved. For stable marriage or not, you see, such a couple will tend to reproduce in their children the same sexual dynamics they represent in themselves. Every family counselor knows that the dominant mother, weak father pattern has very far-reaching consequences in the psychological development of children, particularly of male children. It is the classic environment for the nurture of effeminate and emotionally dependent males. A boy who doesn't have a father with whom he can proudly identify as the leader in the home may well find himself attracted to older boys or men who can fulfill that vital role in his life for him. If he marries at all, it may very well be in order to find a substitute for the mother who has so monopolized his social horizons throughout his childhood. No less than Dr. Spock, when he recanted in the 1970s, you do know, don't you, that Dr. Spock recanted on his first book. When he wrote his second book, Second Thoughts, he picked on this as something he hadn't been sufficiently aware of in his earlier writing. Common in America today, he says, is the father who is a great pal to his son, but leaves all the disciplining to the mother. He may say he doesn't want his son to resent him, the way he sometimes resented his own father. You get a sense in such families that the father feels like one of the children. He cheerfully ignores the little crises that arise. And when his wife realizes what's going on and begs him to take over some of the control, or at least to back her up, he does it all too half-heartedly. Or he gives some excuse about being tired from working all day. Or he doesn't want to come home at the end of the day to be an ogre. In some of these families, the father, without realizing it, is in league with the children and is subtly working against the mother's authority, but in a teasing or absent-minded manner. This reluctance of the father to be a disciplinarian is just as important a problem as that of the father who never plays with the children. It isn't enough for a father to be a pal. A boy should be able to find many pals, but he has only one father. He needs to feel the strength of his father and to have respect for his father as an older, more authoritative person. He is even expected, in nature's scheme of things, I think, to feel at least a little bit of awe for his father. And when a father denies his son these aspects of himself because he's afraid to be anything but a pal, it gets the boy's deeper instincts tangled up inside. Of course, I'm not denying that fulfilling a leadership role in the family is far easier for some men than it is for others. And equally, a submissive role is far easier for some wives than others. Nor am I denying that a certain degree of feminine softness is a redeeming feature in many men who would otherwise be objectionably and insensitively macho. Nor am I denying that there are many women who have a capacity for leadership which must find useful expression. But frankly, if the new and aggressive and independent Sloan Ranger of the 80s means that the families of the 1990s are going to have mothers who are boss, then I fear for the socialization of the next generation. Paul in this chapter is not saying fulfill the role that fits your personal temperament in the home. He's saying fulfill the role that fits your God-given sexual identity in the home. If the family structure of society, with its asymmetric pattern of husband and wife, parent and child, is to be perpetuated, it will only be perpetuated where these sex-linked roles are properly modelled to the next generation. That's why there can be no opting out for us fathers. No matter how much better equipped we may feel our wife is by nature for the task of leading the family and disciplining the children, no matter how much we feel instinctively we'd like to pass it off onto her, it's our job to do it. And a wise wife will recognize that it's our job and do all she can, gently but firmly, to encourage us in doing it. For our children need fathers who model masculinity, and they need mothers who model femininity. And if they don't get such models, we can hardly complain if they grow up confused in their sexual orientation or emotionally ill-equipped to build successful marriages and families for themselves. Paul's advice here then is dreadfully important. Fathers, he says, do not exasperate your children. Literally, don't make them angry. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. And there is no way in which we make children angry more effectively than through neglecting them. Of course, children can be spoilt, overindulged, we all know that. But children can be neglected too. In fact, increasingly, psychologists are characterizing a syndrome they call childhood mourning these days, characterized by emotional frigidity and incommunicativeness on the part of children, which is associated quite clearly with with deprivation of parental attention. The latchkey kids who come home from school to an empty house to prepare their own tea and rehearse the pains and joys of their day at school with nothing but the TV for company. That, of course, raises the other question which people have been asking in relationship to last Sunday's address, which is, what about the vexed issue of the working wife? Clearly, some wives who have chosen not to work wanted me to voice a thorough denunciation of this crime against the family last week, which I neglected to do. Other wives, who feel they have to work, were desperately hoping I might be able to relieve them from their guilt feelings in this matter, which I also failed to do. Well, frankly, I failed to do it because I don't think that Paul would regard the working wife as any more damaging to the child than the working husband. It is the separation of work from the home that has given rise to any number of pressures on family life these days, not least the problem of not having time to spend with the children. In pre-industrial society, husband, wife, and children collaborated on the family farm or in the family craft. They supported the domestic economy together, and they were in one another's company all day long. Industrialization savagely distorted that pattern, forcing the husband to leave home early in the morning and return late at night, often after the children are already in bed, in order that he should be the breadwinner. And a consequence of that was that it left the mother literally holding the baby. She was forced by this absent father to take on the burden of parental responsibility alone. It's not surprising that feminists complain about that. They have every right to complain about that. Industrialization has turned them into domestic slaves who simply are not free to develop themselves in the way their husbands are. And there is no biblical mandate that says it's a mother's job to keep home while father should go out to work at the factory or the bank every day. On the contrary, if the man is to be the leader of the family, he has to be there. It's not working mothers that are the greatest threat to the family, but working fathers, in my view. Why should the mother have to pick up the pieces of a man who is so absorbed in his job he has no time for his own children? Children are just as deprived because dad isn't at home as they are because mum isn't at home. Indeed, sometimes more so. Just listen to this letter, written by a young man at medical school to his psychiatrist. Only now, as I am coming out of my depression, am I beginning to realize what effect my father's absence had on my sense of self-esteem. He gave me everything I needed materially, but what my absent father communicated to me is that I was not really very special. I could not be worth very much as I was, or else why wouldn't Dad spend more time with me? there is a boy who had been exasperated by his father, who had been provoked to anger. Anger, you see, doesn't always explode in adolescent defiance. Anger sometimes, even more frighteningly, is repressed to simmer deep in the subconscious mind of the child, there to become distorted and introverted into a destructive self-hatred that gnaws away at that child's self-confidence and breeds low self-esteem and inferiority feelings and ultimately clinical depression. Oh, of course, negligent mothers who pursue their careers rather than raise their children, they foment such anger. But so too do workaholic fathers. And ultimately, it is their responsibility as leaders in the home to make sure it doesn't happen. We simply must not adopt this mindset of heaping all the responsibility for the children on our wives. Fathers are the leaders of the family. If children are neglected, fathers are to blame. Telling the woman to stop working is not to exculpate ourselves in this matter. Don't exasperate a child then. Don't provoke it to anger. And nothing provokes to anger more seriously than neglect. Rather, he says, it's your business to bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. Notice that phrase, of the Lord. For that means, of course, that we're accountable to the Lord in this matter. Do you remember what Jesus had to say about those who make little ones to sin? Better that he should have a millstone hung around his neck and be drowned in the depths of the sea, he said. Woe to the world because of causes of offense, but woe to those people through whom that offense comes. And there was no exceptive clause, was there, that Jesus appended to that? He didn't say, oh, except parents, of course. No, we shall answer to God for the damage we do to our own children. Yes, they're responsible for their own lives. We can't make them listen to us at the end of the day. They have their role to play in the family. They will answer for their sins of disobedience. But insofar as we unfairly provoke their anger by our neglect or by our abuse of them, insofar as we fail properly to train and instruct them in the Lord, we shall answer for it. And I say again, the most potent educational weapon we have in that respect is the one we use daily without even being aware of it. Our own example. It is the model of manhood and womanhood that we provide that will define the sexuality of our children. It is the model of conduct and character we provide which will define the morality of our children. It is the model of holiness and spirituality we provide which will define the Christianity of our children. It's nearly Christmas, isn't it? Who could miss it? Has it ever occurred to you that in the incarnation, God denied Jesus just about everything? His omnipotence was reduced to a child's weakness. His omniscience limited to a child's intelligence. The wealth of heaven replaced by the poverty of a stable. The adoration of angels by the homage of simple shepherds. All the glory of God veiled in the flesh of a tiny infant. Yet in that momentous humiliation, there was one thing God did not deny Jesus. He did not deny him a happy, God-fearing home. If he really wanted to identify with the world and all its tragedy and its suffering, why was Jesus born to Joseph and Mary? Why wasn't his father a drunkard? Why wasn't his mother a prostitute? Why wasn't he a one-parent child or a victim of sexual abuse? Why on earth did God favor Jesus with such a normal, well-adjusted, highly principled couple of parents? I'll tell you why. Because genes alone do not make us what we are. A vast part of our human nature is acquired, learned, nurtured within the family circle. To fulfill his mission, Jesus had to be a perfect human being. And I suggest to you, the virgin birth alone could not guarantee that perfection. He had to have a good family too. This is the way human beings are made. Not a rich family, not an educated family even, but a family where humility was modeled, both in the loving leadership of the father and in the gentle submissiveness of the mother. Even the Son of God needed that. For happy families matter. They are crucial to the welfare of our society. They are crucial to the very survival of our humanness. Nothing proves that in my mind more conclusively than that nativity scene that we shall be remembering next Sunday. Let's pray together.